Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm back in the United States after approximately 2 to 3 years at the Cannes Film Festival. But I'm happy to be back and obviously turning my eyes towards repertory. And I'm really happy to have a first-time guest. We were going to do it earlier, but I think in the end, it's sort of great that it's happening now because it coincides with a bunch of really cool stuff that's screening in Los Angeles. And the guest is Peter Labuza. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Nick. I actually want to say, I think we met briefly in Cannes in a line back in like 2014. I think it was Godard's Goodbye to Language, possibly.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm at my worst when I'm on my way to, sometimes from a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I don't want to talk to anyone right now. I just want to get in the seat and so finish so I can write this review and move on.
Yeah, definitely. At that point, you were like deep into doing your own podcast, right? The Cinephiliacs.
Yes. Now, more or less defunct, you know, after it had a good 8-year run, could have gone longer. But, you know, I think I turned to different, you know, when I was first, you know, finishing my PhD and then teaching, it was so hard to kind of keep up with everything. And now with my new position, I miss podcasting, but I don't miss doing the work of podcasting.
Yes. No, I know exactly what you mean. Being a kind of one man band, it can take a lot of time. Well, can you say a bit about where you work now?
Sure. I work for the International Cinematographers Guild, better known as IATSE Local 600. So if you know anything about Hollywood unions, you probably know, of course, the Writers Guild, the Directors Guild, and SAG-AFTRA, representing writers, directors, and actors. And then there's one other major union that's kind of evolved. I should say two, partially the Teamsters are involved. And then IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, which is all the below-the-line workers from cinematographers, editors, crafts, hair, makeup, you know, building sets, sound, and we cover everyone at Local 600 who does camera. So if you are touching a camera in some way, whether you're the operator, a first assistant, digital imaging technician, all the way, of course, to cinematographers like Roger Deakins, you're involved in our union, and I'm there to do research. I support the different goals and ends of the union in, you know, doing corporate research and doing research about our members and just kind of all around helping out in the stage.
And yeah, part of what I've been reading is, you know, you've been writing a lot about just kind of history of labor and your research in that on a Substack. And I know you did a lot of research on that before, of course. Obviously, I can't resist asking what you make of, you know, the current strike. Yeah, as much as you can say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think I will say, so Local 600, we support the writers in all their activities, and we hope that they achieve their goals in the end. What they win in their contract will no doubt influence what IATSE will get when we go to the negotiating table in 2024. One of the, I think, the surprising things of this strike has been that I think the writers really have been able to get their ideas and demands out there about how much writing has changed in just the last, you know, 3 to 5 years. I think obviously a lot of that accelerated by COVID. So, right, if you hear about these issues of writers' rooms being essentially decimated and being small, like that is certainly definitely true to an extent. I think, you know, the big question I think that everyone has about, oh, has streaming, you know, destroyed residuals, changed it a lot. What exactly can we do about it? Can we have something akin to go back to the box office? I think is a much more difficult question to figure out what exactly that would look like. Recently, the Directors Guild at least announced a tentative agreement with the AMPTP, that's sort of the negotiating arm of the studios, in which, you know, they had these huge gains in residuals, but not necessarily something akin to data openness. And I know the Writers Guild, too, at least from one of the meetings they did, said they are maybe pushing off on necessarily fighting for that. I think one of the big reasons is I think we are going to see streaming change in the next year or so in a way that's going to be profoundly different. The way that I think I see it, and this is just my personal opinion, I have no inside information that's backing this up, is we're seeing these sort of different types of streaming come together. I'm sure, Nick, you've talked on this podcast about Tubi, right? This sort of goldmine of random films that can be found in the most random places. And you're seeing things like Tubi, Pluto TV, which I believe is run by Universal. Amazon now has Freevee. That these are becoming actually bigger platforms. There was a story in Hollywood Reporter that I forget which show that was produced for Freevee had more viewers than Amazon's own Lord of the Rings show, right? That they spent $500 million on, right? So it just kind of says sort of the weird discrepancies. So I think one of the things that I see happening is advertising is obviously going to have a huge influence on data accessibility, right? And advertisers are not going to advertise at certain limits unless they know how many viewers they're actually getting on shows. They demand a lot of viewers, and there's a lot of things that come with that. And then secondly, I think tied into that is I think you're going to start to see streaming, like the sort of subscriber-based streaming platforms, kind of become closer to, maybe theaters is not the right version of this, but maybe closer to what HBO and right. Cinemax and Stars was in like the 90s and 2000s, where it was like the first place things existed, right? Like, so back in the 2000s, if you didn't have HBO, but you wanted to watch Sex and the City, it eventually came to other networks, right? It would get sold to some, you know, cable channel 506 that you could watch it at, that it would be part of your bundle. And I think that's what we're going to start to see with some of the streaming properties, is more things that are on a platform for 2 to 3 years and then sold somewhere else. I think Amazon actually announced that they were going to do that with The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the Amy Sherman Palladino show, which was a pretty good hit for them, but they want to go sell that to other networks now because there's more money in that. So I think we're already seeing a return to this older version of residuals with a lot more trading, a lot more pushing between markets. Now, I think within that, are the writers going to get a good deal out of that? Are the directors getting a good deal out of that? I don't know necessarily. I mean, it's hard to analyze. And as an IATSE member, our members don't necessarily get those same type of residuals. The IATSE as a whole gets residuals that fund our health and pension plan, but it works slightly different. So I think that's one of the big questions is like, well, is these strikes going to fix the streaming market in a way? My guess is no, but I think that's because it's already kind of in this weird version of self-correction, if that makes sense. I do think the writers should fight for everything they've got on the table. I think so much there is important about what the future of the industry looks like. But I think this sort of question of what is exactly the future of streaming is already changing with or without the strikes.
One of those issues, of course, that gets a lot of press is the role of AI and what that does to the whole equation, really. And I mean, to me, it just seems like a very dangerous moment where you can kind of get the wrong things locked in, the wrong things entrenched that are sort of already in progress. And that, to a certain extent, like streamers smell like blood in the water in terms of what they could try to get in. And having writers become like glorified, like rewriters in a way, or editors in a way. And that, I don't know, as much as one might not like franchise product and say it's formulaic, I mean, I can only imagine what the formulas are going to look like if they start with the AI, but I don't know.
Yeah, the AI question's so weird. I mean, I'm just going back to, I'm sure you've heard this story, right? When John Huston was doing his directorial debut, The Maltese Falcon, and he just handed the book to his secretary and just said, take this book and turn it into a script, right? Like, it's almost like the old school the secretary's being the old school version of AI. I think there's a lot of questions about protecting members' work and getting a sense of what that creativity is going to look like, right? I think one of the things you've seen with, say, consolidation at like Warner Brothers Discovery or Amazon MGM is each one of these studios could easily build a model of AI that doesn't fall into the copyright issues that I think are at the center. This came recently with, it was an AI generated song by Drake, but it had this special loop or marker from this famous producer. So they were able to say, this is copyrightable. You can't do this. Now, if I'm a studio, right? I run Amazon MGM, right? I don't have to worry about copyright because I can just say I've built this AI model that only works on the history of MGM movies. I'm just pulling internally from my copyright. And who knows, maybe the studios all, right, all the members of the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPA, actually, as now it's called, just sort of have a shared AI generator. And I think that's the real terrifying part. So I think the important thing that the unions want to do is there's so many questions about what's this going to look like. You know, there's worst case scenarios and there's ones, right? We see this all the time when like people show AI work online. It's like, well, that looks like absolute junk, where like AI just becomes this whole boondoggle and doesn't work at all. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't fight for the language because you need to prepare for that worst case scenario. Exactly what it's going to look like or how it's going to do things, I think, is a huge question. And I think as a union, we're all about giving our members an opportunity to do work, right? If like there's something small or simple, I think the unions are going to be like, we're going to give you this, you know, I don't know, let's just say like there's a spell checker AI that goes through the script or something. Maybe they would be like, that is fine, right? But I think it's like, we want to be involved in those conversations. I know for Local 600, one of the questions we're having is the question of, you know, virtual production where they've been shooting sort of like, it's almost like a return to the old school rear projection where you kind of are on a set, but then you have all these backgrounds that are kind of LED TVs. They do this for like a lot of the large Marvel and Disney Star Wars products right now. Mm-hmm. And that work isn't necessarily, you know, some of it's based on stuff that our members went out and shot somewhere, but that's an obvious place. If you're just like, give me a sunset and put it into the AI, you know, generator, and you suddenly have that work. It's like, that's work that our members could have been doing and we want to protect. So I think it's hard to know what exactly the future of AI is, but I think it's important to make sure that whatever conversations are happening, that we have as the unions a foot in the door so we can say, hey, isn't this something that our members could be involved with? And I think that's where, if you look at the Writers Guild's at least questions, is that they just want to have a thing that AI cannot replace human work at some point, or there has to be a human author at some point. No one's saying you can't use AI. If you look at actually the demands of the guilds, they're all very reasonable in that way. They're just saying we have to ultimately have a human involved one way or another.
Yeah. It also just makes me worry what happens to like an original work. Like if the original work is always just an amalgam, is that another justification for people to pay people less? Because it's like, oh, well, you never created any original work. Our AI created the original item and then you just did touch-ups on it.
Yeah.
All that stuff just sounds nightmarish.
And of course, what is that original work, right? That original work is based off the original work of thousands of other people. You have to train it on something.
Exactly. Yeah. Fortunately, I can just go to the Halcyon Days, movies from the past that I don't know, someday may end up feeding some AI generator. I don't know. I'm glad that you've been able to see some things at the American Cinematheque, which is putting on, I guess, the second year of a program that sounds, you know, from afar quite interesting. And that is Bleak Week.
Yes.
And first, I just want to start, like, if we can just kind of sketch out the premise of this.
Yeah. Bleak Week, I think the idea was, and I think I'll caveat it this way. Los Angeles Repertory is not necessarily the same as New York Repertory, or there's not the same spaces where, let's just say, if you have an acclaimed art house auteur, like someone like Bellatar, who Bleak Week is a lot dedicated to this time, it's sometimes more difficult in Los Angeles to kind of pull those audiences. I'd say the one place that's really been able to do sort of art house repertory retrospectives has been the UCLA Film and Television Archive, right? So like, I think 6 months ago, they did a Theo on Galopoulos series. That was pretty well attended. But I think there's there's this question with the American Cinematheque, which owns two theaters currently, one in Santa Monica, which is on the west side, and one in Los Feliz, which is kind of in a younger, hipper district. I think they've been really aiming to bring younger audiences back to the theaters, and so I think they want to make programming sound fun and interesting and incredible. So the idea of Bleak Week was, hey, you know all those films that maybe during COVID you thought, oh, is this my chance to watch this serious film that maybe was on a Sight and Sound list, but it's 2.5 hours long and it's really depressing. And what we want to kind of do is make it into, honestly, a challenge, right? Like, it's like, come challenge yourself. Come, you know, see these serious films and let's all be depressed together. And we'll take a little, you know, a little winking in the face over the idea that, like, oh, we're all coming together to watch very, very serious films. But hopefully what you're going to do is you're going to experience some of the greatest films ever made, or certainly some of the most unique and interesting films. And so, you know, this series has been, I don't know how many films. I want to say it was like 40 plus films. 35 films, actually, 20 countries, you know, and a very wide range of films, from, you know, serious films from European art houses to Asia to even some films that some mainstream Hollywood affair. So I know critic Katie Walsh introduced the director's cut of Alien 3, the David Fincher film. I know there's some other films that are sort of, you know, maybe wouldn't necessarily be considered like kind of classic hardcore art house films, but are giving the sense that, like, hey, there is this kind of films that we don't necessarily program otherwise, and this is our chance to kind of bring those together.
Yeah, no, definitely no knock against it. I really like it. Also, just I think it really responds to the importance of having community. I mean, I love that you framed it in terms of, like, watching these movies alone might, especially at the depths of a pandemic, might not be so appealing. But when you bring people together, I mean, honestly, I almost thought of something like a Cure concert in a way, you know, like, although it is nice to listen to the Cure alone and just sob in a room. But yeah, just coming together with people to watch these. And yeah, it also interesting that it brings back maybe a couple of auteurs that aren't in circulation as much. Not that they've stopped entirely making work, although at least one of them notably has, Bellatar, but, you know, someone like Gus Van Sant,
right,
or Alexander Sokurov, who continues to direct movies. I mean, I think he had something at Locarno last August that was like a deep fake.
That's the only thing I know about it too, and I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, so he's still doing his own thing. So maybe we can start there, because I know that you saw a couple of Sokurov films that are both from the 90s, beginning and end, right?
Yeah, it was definitely early career. So I've been a big fan of, you know, Sokurov. You know, obviously, like everyone, my first introduction was Russian Ark, his sort of, you know, I guess, quasi one take film, 2000 shots, if you can read some film theorists instead. And I think, you know, particularly, I think films like, I really love his Faust adaptation that is just so cacophonous and strange. And so, but I hadn't seen any of these early films that he had done. So they had a double feature, including then a virtual Q&A that they had pre-recorded with Sokurov, the that Chris Lemaire, who is one of the programmers of Bleak Week, had done. The first film, I guess, is Mother and Son. It's from 1997. It was his, I guess, from my understanding, I was not around really following his types of films in the 90s, but that was his breakout film that kind of got people to pay attention that he was an interesting, unique artist. And I mean, this film is so hard to describe in some ways, because it really kind of is on that precipice of, is this a narrative film or is this more something that you would see in, like, you know, at New York Film Festival and Views from the Avant-Garde, because it's so barely unnarrative. There's like, I don't know how many lines of dialogue in it, but it's like, and Sokurov said he barely used the script. He was using non-professional actors. And it's just really this mother and son at first walking around this landscape somewhere in Russia, but it's all like the frames are so smeared and with different filters. And so every frame, you know, the sort of classic, every frame looks like a painting. It's like, oh no, every frame does look like a painting because it has this impressionistic filter over it. And it's just this, you know, son who takes his mother basically out for a walk, which, you know, we can kind of tell is going to be either her last walk or last time outdoors, and them just sort of staring into these impressionistic landscapes. It's very hard to describe like what happens, because that's basically it, is that, you know, they go walk around, he takes her back, and then, you know, spoiler alert, she eventually passes on. And it just sort of has a sense of, I think for people who love Sokurov, the sense of time, because it's so slow and just kind of lets, you know, there's this amazing sound design where the wind is just kind of howling through the space. And particularly, I think there's this famously weird distorted images. I know that Sokurov did a lot of different techniques shooting through glass panes and mirrors and different lenses. The best way to describe it is it looks like the film was shot in a 4:3 Academy aspect ratio, but it's projected in 1:6:6, the European widescreen. So it always feels like the characters are like flatter and wider, and this kind of adds that feeling that like, oh, he's really just pulling from paintings, because it feels like these characters are just these impressionistic elements.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen it in a while, so I was just kind of refreshing my memory a little with it, and it's really amazing how he keeps returning to, I mean, I should know exactly how he's achieving the look, but I'm not sure I do. I mean, in this case, just that it almost looks like dimmed or sepia toned in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, even like whatever, 10 years later, he's using, I don't know, something like Alexandra, you know, that one about like the mother of a soldier.
Oh, yeah.
Who again, the kind of structure there is just this kind of like spirit walk through this windswept area. And I'm trying to figure out like what does that mean in a way, you know, like is using that kind of, I'll call it a filter, even though I know that's not exactly what it is, but is using that like a way of kind of expressing how this like post-Soviet landscape is totally suffused with history, that it's kind of like, we couldn't just have like a one-to-one, like, you know, whatever, razor sharp view of what the world is in that moment, because it's just so heavy somehow. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating how abstract the film is, that, right? Like, you don't get a sense of where, like, I mean, it's this beautiful pictorial landscape, but you have no idea where it could be in anywhere in Russia. The details you learn about the two characters, I think there's just like, there's like a brief reference maybe where it seems like she's referring to a former lover that the son didn't know about. But like, that was like the one plot detail that was ever sort of suggested. Instead, it just, I mean, it really feels in a way almost deliberately apolitical in a way, that it's so separated out from the time and space, particularly as we'll get to with The Second Circle, the other Sokurov film that I was able to see in this series, which is so specific to a place and time in the Soviet Union in 1990. This film feels like almost like trying to be removed at the same time, right? I think you're right that it is about this sort of like feeling of alienation from the entire world and just feeling lost in space and time, which would be like obviously a sort of post-Soviet malaise in a way.
Yeah. And then the other one that you saw is The Second Circle, which I think is that 90 around there?
Yeah. 1990 was when it came out. And then I don't think it played in New York until like a couple years later, which is very fascinating. I mean, I'd never heard of this one before. I think someone said it's like technically his second movie, but I think depends on how you're counting different types of work that he was doing, whether it's fiction or not fiction. But it's also about a son who comes to a town that Sokurov said in the Q&A, they shot it in very close to the Arctic Circle, and at night it would get 25 degrees below. And I believe that's Celsius, not Fahrenheit. So very cold. It's this tiny frozen town. In the first scene, we more or less learn that the son's father, who's a former Soviet military general, has died. And the film is basically about him trying to get rid of this body and take care of the things that you need to do when a loved one passes on. So in that way, it feels very, you know, spiritually connected to the mother and son. But this one is, it's at sometimes a bleak comedy. It's at sometimes feels in that Sokurov sense of just like contemplating time and mortality. I mean, the body itself is very present in this film and has this mummy-like, you just see the skin and it's all shot. Again, a weird cinematography trick where a lot of the film is like, I don't want to say in black and white, it's just like the color's been drained out of the frame, but not necessarily the grayscale. And so the body literally looks like it's mummifying before our eyes. And, you know, the son is like, he's not been living in the town for many years. He clearly has been living in Moscow or somewhere like a more modern city. And he's just like confused at all these details. And, you know, there's some of those like classic tropes of, say, Soviet bureaucracy where he has to go get a death certificate. And then particularly he has to deal with this undertaker who is very, very curt and doesn't want to deal with any of his BS. And I think in what I guess is probably the most famous sequence of the film, it takes them 20 minutes to get the body into a coffin and then get it out of the apartment, and they're banging it everywhere and they got to get ropes. And it, you know, it's just this sort of thing that's very funny at the same time, but it's very sad. And I think what Sokurov does with it is just kind of get this sense of like where you're seeing this, like the weight that dead bodies create for, you know, children. I think there's this quote at the end, right? I forget what it is exactly, but it's something about like, blessed are those who go before us because they're spared with having to deal with us or something like that. Like it's something about that where it's just like the pain of having to take care of the death of a loved one is just so much. In like, you know, this apartment that the father had been living is just grimy and bleak and very fits into that time of, this is 1990, so just Soviet collapse, imminent collapse, or basically on the verge of, you know, the end of the Soviet Union, and just feeling like there's nothing there, and just in this like very desolate town that we don't see much of except for the snow piled everywhere.
Yeah it's yeah, it's funny to think of this as like an endorsement of like, now go out and see this movie, you know? Like,
yeah.
But that's the premise of the series, and that's why I love it. So yeah, those are the two Sokurovs. And then while we're talking a bit about just the landscapes and the kind of the general feeling of a burden and kind of struggling through the present, I thought a little bit about like a Bellatar movie. You know, I guess they're showing restorations that are going around. And mm-hmm. I think you've said that those have been pretty well attended. I mean, he's kind of like rock star status, more or less.
I think the Sokurovs, which were a Monday night, were the only thing I went to that was a little not well attended. His name isn't certainly as big as someone like Bellatar or like, you know, Gus Van Sant, which they showed Jerry. It's kind of interesting, right? Like any type of repertory program where you have your rock star hits, the things that are going to bring in an audience, and then you hope you can kind of attract people to a few other types of films. So I think, you know, the Bellatars have been, because it was the first time he's been in the United States since 10 years. So I guess probably around the time when Turn Horse had been playing, and they brought him out. Everything, obviously, at this point, I think almost all of his films have DCP restorations that have been done and are in circulation, although I think they did show a few film prints as well.
It's kind of remarkable to think that someone like that can just stop making movies, and it's felt like to a large extent he really did do that. I mean, I remember interviewing him when Turin Horse happened, and that was like the news. I also like the idea that that could be like news, that like Bellatar and stuff, like the filmmaking.
And I think like particularly because we've heard about, you know, like Steven Soderbergh has quote unquote retired how many times to only make 7 new features a year. And then obviously like Quentin Tarantino keeps threatening to do it after, I guess, his next movie. But to actually see, you know, a director decide, I think I'm actually done, right? And I thought I saw some actor said that they're moving to France.
Oh yeah, Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, he's just gonna move to France, which actually sounds delightful.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, definitely. They'll just do a Bryan Cranston AI generator. So
Jesus.
It'll happen. So that was the Sokurov couple of films. And then you saw, also staying in the same supercontinent, a Eurasian supercontinent, mm-hmm. you saw a couple of movies that I think I was saying before we started recording are two movies that I'm just frankly afraid to rewatch. Like a good war movie should be one you don't want to watch again.
Yeah, Ellen Klimov's Come and See, and then Larissa Shepetko's The Ascent. I think one of the things, just to return to a great point of doing Bleak Week, these are films both on the most recent Sight and Sound list. I think The Ascent was on the director's list in the top 100 and was kind of maybe a little bit of a surprise for some people. But films I just hadn't seen for one reason or another. And I was like, well, you know, it's Friday night, there's no basketball on, so this is like a perfect way to spend my Friday night. But right, in a way, it's like you want to kind of sometimes catch up with these canon films you've not seen. And sometimes I think what's interesting is how they surprise you. I think particularly Come and See, you know, which for better or worse is often, say, a meme on Twitter for various reasons, right? Because that, you know, the face of the boy in the film is just so iconic. I think what surprised me about Come and See is I think for the first half of the film, it was not what I necessarily expected, but it was much more surreal and much more even comedic or absurdist than I had necessarily expected. Come and See, right, is this film takes place in Belarus in 1943, mostly dealing with this boy named Flora, who is, you know, either forced or decides to join up with the Soviet partisan forces at a point in the war where things aren't particularly going well. In the first maybe half hour, he's in this camp in the forest. Everyone leaves to go fight this battle, but he sticks around because he has to give up his shoes. He meets this young girl who is working as a nurse named Glasha, and they are attacked, and then they end up on this surrealist journey. So obviously it has this incredible violence in the film, but it can also be very weird and absurdist. So there's this, you know, scene where he believes that his family, who've been clearly, obviously murdered, are hiding on this island, and they have to drag themselves through the mud. And that's the thing about Klimov here, right, is it's so material-based. Like, there's no way that's like, oh, they were actually totally fine. It was like, no, you can see their bodies are dragging through the mud. There's no fakery here. And I think that's part of it. But then there's this, I don't want to say comic sequence, right, but where him and a few other soldiers have to go try and steal a cow to bring to, you know, these families, these women and children who are just starving to death. And it just goes poorly wrong in this extremely absurdist way. And like, I think it's that totality of like all these sort of materials of just like the war as absurd idea that kind of build until, of course, the second half of the film, which mostly deals with the slaughter of this one village, which is just absolutely horrifying and just intense in the way that, you know, his camera is just always right in the main character Flora's face and just creating this sense that you cannot escape out of this movie.
I mean, the second half is where the people are herded into a barn and that's burnt. Yep. I mean, the barn burning sequence is just, I'm dumbstruck when I think about it. And I just think it's also a sequence that has resonated far and wide. I mean, obviously, historically, that happened. But I think there's also something very primal about that, that image. It's mm-hmm. is awful. Ari Aster has written about Come and See as kind of a big movie for him.
Yeah, there's a certain subjectivity throughout the film. I think there's a sense, particularly in the war film genre, right? There's, I think, always a debate between, like, are you trying to depict things objectively or subjectively? Thinking of, like, you know, the Saving Private Ryan, of, like, trying to have this documentary style versus, you know, Klimov, who I think really kind of embraces the idea that it should have this surrealist attitude, but not surrealist in a positive way. It's surrealist in the horrors and, you know, obviously the long tracking shots through these types of spaces he's working with, the sound design, where I think for almost an hour of the film, all the dialogue is essentially muddled because the character's been, you know, hit by a shell and can barely hear a thing. And he really embraces that idea that this child is just thrown into situation after situation with no reprieve from anything. Although there is that sequence early in the film where him and the woman Glasha are like dancing around right after all these shells have bombed down on them.
Right.
And it feels like can be these moments where you can find some, you know, at least joy or whatever, but then that ends quickly. But it has these fascinating color design, and it's so hard to describe, I guess, because it's got so much going on in it. Except for, like, if you just describe, you know, the war crimes going on, of just watching the slaughter of women and children that, you know, the particularly the Nazis participate in here. This film, I believe, was technically commissioned by the Soviet Union for a particular anniversary. So I think if there may have been a different type of film that would have, you know, critiqued some of the tactics of the Russian military at the time that are certainly left out.
Right. No, that is a good point to mention. There's a movie that was at Berlin like a couple of years ago during the pandemic, Natural History, a Hungarian film that, I don't know, is one of the movies or more recent war movies that bears influences of Come and See. So Come and See, which is 1985. The other one you saw was from the 70s, The Ascent.
The Ascent, I knew nothing going in. I think in a way, like, Come and See was this film that at least I knew a lot about as this, you know, hardcore war film. And I think, as you said, like, has been talked about endlessly by filmmakers, right? Whether it's Ari Aster, and you can see some of the influence of Midsommar. I believe, like, Daniel Goldhaber talked about it in the making of How to Blow a Pipeline, as a, you know, where he pulled a couple shots from it. The Ascent, I think, fits more into, like, what we imagine a traditional Soviet war movie to be. I was thinking, like, it has kind of some of the influence of, like, Ivan's Childhood as like an early Tarkovsky, or I'm trying to think of, I believe there's an Alexei Gurman film from the 70s. Is it 20 Days Without War is the name of that one? Where I think The Ascent kind of fits into that genre in a way. It certainly fits in that style. It starts out as a hardcore realist film, and it's not even clear what the plot is going to be. It opens with like a caravan of soldiers and women and children. They're in this extremely snowy mountain environment. They get attacked by Nazi soldiers coming by, and they go and hide on this mountain, but they don't have any food. So two soldiers are kind of sent down. One is Sotnikov, which is played by Boris Plotnikov, who doesn't want to go on this, but wants to help his friend and wants to help the people. But he's like already, he's got a cough at first. And then Rybak, played by Vladimir Goslykin, is the more like stern, hardcore, I will do anything for my people person. And I think what's going to be interesting in the film is how those roles slightly reverse through the film, because, you know, they make it to one village, they can't get anything. I believe Stolnikov gets shot in the leg, and they're just trying to escape and find peace. And they make it to this woman's house where they're hiding in the attic, and Nazis come, and they eventually get captured and put in a POW camp. And that's where the film kind of starts to change from this more realist adventure into a much more like a Bergman psychological drama about like, what's the right thing to do? Is someone going to rat someone out? Is someone going to help the others escape? And they're all trying to figure out. And I think you see the personalities of the characters emerge in a way where I think Rybak was seen as a strong, stern, do anything for someone person, becomes this weaker character who doesn't know exactly what to do. You start to see these fantasies where he imagines himself escaping, but then getting shot, and that's why he cowers. While Soltnikov becomes this character who sort of becomes more ethereal, and the way that is, you know, you see particularly in the performance, seems almost outside of this world, like he's looking in at his body and trying to rationalize and do the right thing for these other people who are in the POW camp who've kind of been unfairly captured with them. And yeah, I think what Shepiko does is it's just like she really starts to turn what felt like an ordinary genre film into something extraordinary and much more spiritual.
I mean, this is all the more reason for me to watch it again. Also, probably in better quality than when I saw it. I think I saw it before there was the Criterion edition of it. I'm very much tragic that she was not able to make movies after that.
Larissa Shepetko was married to Klimov and passed away very sadly maybe 2 years after she had made that film, and I think a couple other films. And I believe Klimov made a documentary about her at some point that's supposed to be quite good and quite moving. I think it's a surprising film. You know, I really wanted to see it because I'm always curious about those films that end up on the Sight and Sound directors list, but I don't think place high necessarily on the critics list.
Interesting.
Because, you know, I think those films sometimes it can be revealing. And it was this film that, you know, I think I'd heard of before, but not necessarily knew much about. And I think, you know, like in a way that many women directors are starting to be more recognized for their work, this was one that I think a lot of people are pointing to. It's like so interesting to see how she kind of pulls from that genre and then takes it in a completely different route. And of course, it has this just gorgeous, amazing climax of the film that maybe I'll hold back, but you know, it's just this cacophony of events bring you into the psychology of these five major characters at a moment of pure crisis. And I think the way that she really finds a way to give their interior psychology will also give them dignity at this horrible moment in their lives is very key, and I hadn't seen necessarily depicted in a film before. So it was just kind of a very surprising film in a way. And I think also just comparing the two, I feel like Shepiko is doing something psychologically similar, but approaches it much more through that spiritual religious element. I think Scorsese's talked about this film before, and you can definitely see the influence in how he, you know, tries to pull from both documentary and subjectivity so closely.
Yeah, that sounds exactly right. So that's The Ascent. I want to just squeeze one more movie, if we could, that you also saw there, because, I mean, he's a filmmaker I just really love, Simon Leong. But an earlier film that I don't know if people really watch as much. I mean, I think I want to give credit to Reverse Shot. They did a whole symposium on his work pretty early in the 2000s. And I think that's probably when I first saw The River. Is this the first time you saw this one?
Yeah, it's the first time. I love Tsai Ming-liang. When I used to teach, I would show Goodbye Dragon Inn or certainly clips from that, but also, you know, Stray Dogs. I love the Walker films. I find them so endlessly fascinating partially because, you know, Lee Kang-Xiang is just this fascinating character, and Rebels of the Neon God was restored a few years back, and that one's, you know, his debut film is great, but I'd not seen The River, which is just so fascinating and so strange. I mean, my first reaction was, you know, throughout the film, Lee Kang-Xiang, basically in the beginning of the film, he's working on a film set with director An Hui playing herself, and they're having problems in this very amusing scene where they have a dummy that's supposed to be a dead body floating in the river, and the dummy doesn't look right, and so An Hui convinces Lee Kang-Xiang's character to literally play the dead body floating in the river. But then basically after that, he has a crick in his neck that is just debilitating pain throughout the rest of the movie. And as someone in their mid-30s, I very much related to the idea of having a sudden pain in your neck that you cannot get out no matter what you do. You just feel it in the body. Personally, because Lee Kang-Shang's so good. Like, it is so believable he's got this pain, right? Like, I think that's the thing about him as an actor and why Tsai's been always, you know, attracted to using him is who else uses their body with such believability in that way for these, like, physical things that he does, whether, you know, when he plays the Walker character and feels like he truly is a monk, to, you know, some of the things that he's done in other films, and particularly to see him in this young, you know, he's very young, he's very beautiful in a way that I don't, you know, we don't usually talk about the beauty of Tsai's characters, but he's just a very attractive young man. But, you know, this film, it has a lot of rain. Classic in any Tsai film. There's leaks happening in this apartment. And I learned from the introduction by Ryan Swen is that, you know, these are basically the characters from Rebels of a Neon God kind of continued on, where you have this father character who's trying to deal with this rain that's constantly coming down in his apartment, but he's also, you know, visiting these brothels. The mother character who's not speaking to, none of them seem to really speak to each other at all. She is sleeping with another person. But I think is the key is this relationship between the father and Lee Kangsheng's character, which of course comes together in this extremely unexpected way in this shot that's both horrifying and beautiful. It looks like a Pedro Costa frame that seems to create some relief for the Lee Kangsheng character for a brief moment before the horror of what has transpired is revealed. And I think that's one of the things with Tsai is, you know, he has this very realist sense of Taipei. And then he finds these spaces where it just feels like you've entered like a David Lynch universe, but he treats it with such respect and beauty. It's so hard to describe what he's doing so often because the camera's very still, and yet the duration turns things around from something that might be read one way into something that's read very differently.
Yeah, and just that it becomes this almost non-physical, purely psychological space. I mean, or just a very bodily psychological space.
Yeah.
And I like what you said about Lee Kangsheng's body just being, I mean, it's just this very thick presence. I don't know how else to describe it, you know, on the screen.
Yeah.
And this comes up, I don't know if it's the same neck ailment, but that comes up in Days, right? That he's undergoing all these treatments. The one from 2 or 3 years ago, he's getting all these weird like electrical things that he's having done to his back. So this kind of ongoing thing of this pain that can never quite be salved.
Yeah, I still haven't seen Days. And it's because I wanted to see, you know, again, with this Bleak Week issue, it's like, these are films that are so designed for a theater, right? Come and see. Worth seeing in a theater. The River, so worth seeing in a theater with an audience that's slowly learning these elements. And so, you know, when Days came out, I didn't get the chance to see it in the theater, and then it was COVID, and I'm just kind of waiting for someone to show it again in LA, just because it feels like one that one experience, you know, sitting in the dark with a group of people as opposed to just, you know, on my couch.
No, completely. And I mean, I had experienced that just recently with Birth, the Jonathan Glazer film.
Oh, yeah.
Which the last time I saw was at home. And, you know, yeah, definitely trippy enough. But watching that with the like full organism of an audience that you're part of, I mean, his movies just seem to have that effect. And I have to attribute, you know, part of the response to Zone of Interest being the way just he's able to hold, has this like bodily hold on the audience through his filmmaking. And Birth, yeah. I mean, when you're sitting with an audience, looking at that close-up on Nicole Kidman in the concert for 2 or 3 minutes is, yeah, kind of a transcendent experience. So yeah, The River, I think that's the last thing we'll have from Bleak Week. But you also saw another film, Iguana. And also, can you explain where that was showing?
Yeah, so Iguana was shown. This is a Monty Hellman film from the 80s as part of a series that Micah Gottlieb has started in Los Angeles called Mezzanine. I've known Micah for years since he was in college, and he started this programming series mostly to show, I guess, what you would call repertory filming that wouldn't necessarily have a space as broad and great as the LA repertory scene has got between the American Cinematheque, UCLA, Academy Museum, the New Beverly. Vidiot's just opened. This was a movie rental house in Santa Monica. Now it's in Eagle Rock, which is in the east side of LA, and it's both a movie rental house as well as a movie theater. Mezzanine is kind of catching all those types of films that might not necessarily show anywhere else. And so, you know, it's been a pretty eclectic set of programming, and I haven't gotten to every screening just because, you know, timing, life, family, but, you know, they've shown films by Jacques Rivette, like Up, Down, Fragile. They had Michael Almereyda in town for his big debut VHS film, Another Girl, Another Planet. I saw Milestones, which was the documentary from Robert Kramer and John Douglas about sort of the fallout of radicals in the 1960s and 70s. I think he did a Weissman film. But then Iguana was, I went in thinking Monty Hellman, it's surely going to be a genre film. And for the most part, it is a genre film. And this was like the ultimate film maudite in the 1980s. It was Italian produced. The, you know, producer basically stole the film from Hellman, edited it the way he wanted. It barely got a release, but as screenwriter Stephen Gatos, who had recorded an introduction, explained, it had three major important fans at the time. One was Bill Crone of Kaidu Cinema. One was Joni Mitchell, who does a song at the end of the film over the most horrifying last frame of a movie you could imagine. And the other was someone who watched it when it came out on VHS in their video store, which was Quentin Tarantino. And Gatos and Hellman obviously became helpful in producing some of Reservoir Dogs for Tarantino. So Iguana is this film that takes place in the 19th century. It deals with this character, Everett McGill, who people might recognize from Twin Peaks. He has this deformity on his face that looks like he has scales, though it's never explained where that comes from or how he got that. It's just, I think, something he was born with. And he is sort of this character who ends up on this island with a couple other people and decides, after all the cruelty he's been shown in the world, that he is going to declare himself god of this island and, you know, serve just punishment and turn everyone to slaves. So it's this very interesting, fascinating parable of who controls your life and your destiny. And it has, like, you know, his character really reminds me of some of, like, the Nietzschean elements that you see in certain Bresson characters. The film is gorgeous. We saw it on a DCP, though. If there's any 35 millimeter print, it would be even better to look at, because it's, a lot is set in these caves with this great orangish hues of light. And it's this just sort of grim parable that takes place on this island of, like, you know, really material earthiness. There's some really intense action sequences briefly, some big fights. You see these characters working through their existence in this space where they may never escape. And whether, how do you submit yourself to a force that you know is wrong based on everything else and you know from living in society, and yet you have no other choice? It is just absolutely wild and hard to describe in a way that I think if you try and describe any Monty Hellman film, you start to run into ways of, like, well, I'm not really describing it right. But I was really glad Micah showed it. I think he's just continues to show more and more interesting films. And I, like, if you have a chance to see this film, it is not what you expect at all. And particularly the final shot of the film is just both beautiful and the most horrifying thing you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, that was a big loss, I guess. Almost maybe got a little lost in the pandemic. I mean, when Monty Hellman died, I guess, in 2021.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, I haven't really seen a close to full retrospective being mounted since then. Maybe there is, and did you notice one?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, that seems, I don't know. I mean, a lot of his work has been available on, I guess, even just on Criterion, but seems like that would be a good thing for someone to do. Yeah, also, then I'd hopefully get to see Iguana on a big screen.
Yeah.
I think we might be able to finish there with Iguana. I'll throw my own film viewing hat in.
Please do.
Something that I saw just recently, because it's on Le Cinema Club for one of their week-long online engagements, which usually I always click too late. But in this case, I saw it. And it's one that I think you were telling me was shown in L.A. a few months ago, you said?
Yeah, a couple of months ago, but I missed it.
Yeah, and then also in New York, I think it was at the Roxy, Yeast, directed by Mary Bronstein. I guess it's often kind of lumped in with mumblecore. I usually like to think of Frownland as like hyper-real mumblecore, which is like, what if the people were like really just completely steer into the abyss of like anxiety? And Yeast, I think, stares right at kind of toxic friendships in a way. It centers on a woman she's about to leave her apartment to go on a camping trip, but her roommate / friend just does not want to go for no discernible reason. So it kind of starts off with an argument, and then she goes on the camping trip with actually a character played by Greta Gerwig, who plays a kind of like sort of a kooky stoner to a certain extent, but also just like a very just extra person. And a part of the vibe you get in the beginning is that, like, she wants to go, the main character played by Mary Brownstein, mm-hmm. wants to go on this trip, but it's really the sort of thing where you need someone else there to kind of dilute the friend who's just a little too much to take on your own. So that's part of it. And you get the sense that the main character has these kind of tendencies of that don't always endear her to her friends, but her friends are also no picnic either. So that's kind of the dynamic that the movie works through. And I really just kind of admired how it was very unsparing in that, you know, just kind of backbiting that can occur. And I mean, I saw it described on Liz as being like the tragedy of being 20s in New York, being in your 20s in New York. But I just also like these particular characters, you know, and I love the like location. I mean, also Sean Price Williams, although just credited as Sean Williams, appears here. And then there's this whole final sequence, which I don't really want to give away, which just takes it to a whole other interesting level. But it's just mining this like sore tooth of passive aggression and dysfunction and all of this without pushing it to the extent of subjective horror of Frownland, basically.
Mm.
So yeah, Yeast, I mean, I hope it eventually gets the kind of renown that Frownland is a Criterion DVD. It's on Criterion now.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to compare these two, but it's just one of these notable things. Like, these things came out with 2 years of each other. I think Yeast is doing also great things. So, yeah, I hope people see it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I saw it. That was on Lay Cinema Club and wanted to catch up. I feel like we're just kind of entering maybe that period where we can finally look back at the mumblecore thing with like a little more searching and curiosity, because it was like, you know, there was a certain directors and filmmakers like Gerwig, like Joan Swanberg, who kind of emerged out of it and, you know, reached something of names that were recognized. And there was all these other films, right, that kind of disappeared and seemed to didn't exist. And so I know when Micah programmed this at first, I was like, I don't know what this film is. It sounds fascinating. I want to see it. And I think it's glad we're now able to go back and look at that period without maybe the veneer of like, oh, what are these films that are, you know, poorly shot on DV and, you know, just with actors who don't seem to know what they're doing, and actually look and see like, oh, what is happening in these films? What are we actually seeing on screen? And I feel like that's what we're finally now 15 years removed from this era able to do.
Yeah. And also admire when there is real craft to, you know, kind of shaky camera. What then would have just been described as this kind of, yeah, like shoestring budget, shaky camera work or something. Because there are a lot of moments where I'm just like, how did they even block that out? I mean, that's really, you know, at one point they go to some Burger King truck stop and like the scene kind of rests on Bronstein's character as she kind of rests her arms and just rests on this like railing and watches whatever like is the latest thing that the Greta Gerwig character is getting up to. And it was just settled in this setting like, oh, wow, this is a great composition, right? Like, how did we even get here, you know? So I really appreciate that kind of artfulness, you know, and the sound is also kind of that assaultive, like there's a bar scene where you can't there's this sleazoid kind of comes up and hits on them and you can't understand half of what he's saying. And it just becomes like part of his character. Also, there is a scene with Josh and Benny Safdie that is kind of funny, looking very, very young, that they run into on the camping trip. So yeah, as a reminder, this is the sort of thing where it's only up for a week. And I don't even know when that week started. It might've been Friday. So get to it. Yeast. We'll wrap it up there. Peter, it's been a great journey. Thank you for sharing. I've been really so excited by seeing all the stuff that's screening in Los Angeles.
Yeah, absolutely. I think LA, particularly post-pandemic, I think there's a younger generation who really wants to embrace going to a movie theater. I'm always surprised more and more often when I go to something that I think, you know, before the pandemic would have been 20 people and now it's 200. And it's a problem for me because it's like, oh, I didn't buy my ticket ahead of time. Oh, I can't get my favorite seat. I think it's good, encouraging to see. I think people embracing, you know, going to the movies and keeping these theaters alive. And, you know, there's more theaters still coming in some ways because Tarantino's got a second theater that should be opening at the end of the year, and The Egyptian's going to be reopening, which is partially going to be programmed by the American Cinematheque. So it just seems to be this, you know, growing space of interesting viewing, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. And happy viewing.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.